Good afternoon. Calling State Affairs to order at 3:06 p.m. Thursday, March 17, in the Max Grinberg Room. Members present from my left to my right, Representatives Vance, Tarr, Kaufman, and Story, and myself, Chair Christ Tompkins. That gives us 5 members present, informed to conduct business. As a note, Representative Clayman is presenting a bill up on the fifth floor, so he'll be down here in a little bit, and Representative Kaufman may be heading out to do similar. So little bit of musical chairs. Thank you, Sophia and Lydia, for facilitating today's meeting, as well as Jeff Stepp, our committee aide. And a couple of housekeeping items before we go into the three-part agenda. HB 396, relating to Russian entity divestiture, is removed from today's agenda, and we'll be hearing public testimony on that legislation on Tuesday, as well as the governor's HB 401 on Tuesday. And the amendment deadline, as previously noticed for HB 309, for the APOC contribution POFD bill that we heard yesterday, is going to be Sunday, submitted to Legislegal by 5 p.m., and then submitted to my office by Monday at 5 p.m. And for anyone who's thinking about amendments, I would strongly encourage you to consult me, because I have a good number in the works, in part because of what we heard in testimony on Tuesday. And so just to avoid duplicative effort or harmonize energies, that might be advisable. And then on House Bill 142 was communicated to members last night, and I think also by email this morning, Representative McCurdy's PFD eligibility bill. That's the same amendment deadline, Sunday 5 p.m., Monday 5 p.m., submission to legal and submission to my office respectively. So with that, we can dive into the first agenda item, and we have a confirmation hearing for Commissioner Designee Paula Vrana. Welcome. You can come forward and put yourself on record, and if you'd like to make opening comments to the committee, you're most welcome, and then we can open it up for questions.
Thank you very much, Chair Christ Tompkins. It's my pleasure to be here before you today as you consider my appointment. For the record, my name is Paula Vrana, and I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Administration. Just a little bit about my background. I thought I would start with a brief history of my work experience, education, and a little bit about me personally. I have a degree in business administration from Boise State University. I also attended the University of Puget Sound. I have a Juris Doctorate degree from the University of Idaho, and I've been practicing law in the state of Alaska since 1998. I worked for about 13 years at the law firm of Brenna Bell & Clarkson as a practicing attorney, and I also worked there for a couple of years during law school for a total then of about 15 years at that law firm. I served as the managing attorney for many of those years, and we practiced mostly oil and gas administrative law. It was very dense and tedious work, as you might imagine, and I longed for more personal interaction and a little bit of an opportunity to work more closely with people. So I decided to transition my career path, and I accepted the position of Chief Executive Officer for Copper River Native Association. I worked there for about 3.5 years, and one of the projects that I'm most proud of in my career is the project of the Copper River Native Association New Health Clinic in the Glen Allen area. It was a $20 million project, and I was really lucky enough to be able to see that project through from start to finish. From the design, from the selection of the architect, the selection of the engineers, the selection of the construction company, the securing of the financing, and the building of the facility. So I was very pleased to have been able to see that through right to the grand opening of that facility. After that, I took about 4 years off, and I stayed at home with my young sons, and we played a lot of hockey and did a lot of you know, we had a lot of fun adventures on our farm. And then I began work as the executive director for a year for Hospice of Anchorage. Very, very fulfilling work. It was really my privilege to have been a part of that organization and to be a part of the incredible work that that hospice workers and hospice organizations, you know, that service that they provide to people going through usually the most difficult times of their life. After that, I began work at the Department of Administration. I have been at the Department of Administration for a little over 3 years now, just a hair over 3 years. Most of those years, I served as the deputy commissioner. It has given me really a broad and deep understanding of the Department of Administration. It's a complex and diverse department, and there was a lot to learn, and I still have a lot to learn. I think I learn something new every day at the Department of Administration, but it's been a wonderful experience working with incredible leadership at the department and truly an incredible group of employees at the department, very dedicated, loyal people that I've had the, you know, again, the privilege to work with the people at the Department of Administration. A little bit about me personally. I grew up in Skagway. My parents were both born there. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've lived in Wasilla for about 24 years. I've been married for almost 27 years. I have two sons. My oldest son is a senior at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the mining engineering program. And my youngest son is a senior at Colony High School in Palmer. We have a small farm where we raise horses and hay. And although I would have to say I haven't had much time for farming these days, but it is something that I love and that's near and dear to my heart. I think that pretty much sums up my background and my history. And I appreciate your consideration of my appointment today. And I'm available for questions, Chair Price-Tompkins.
Thank you very much for those introductory comments. Well, I can kick things off. Did you know Mr. Brenna going up in Skagway? Or is that just a coincidence?
Yes, Chair. I did know Mr. Brenna from Skagway. Yes.
Small town.
Yes.
That would be inevitable.
Yes.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, welcome Ms. Brenna, commissioner appointee. With the transition to this managing the department, what are your goals, in some differences that you want to bring to finish out this appointment?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Vance, for that question. My goals for the Department of Administration are pretty straightforward, and they are to finish well what we've begun at the Department of Administration. Most people are aware that the Department of Administration has several large initiatives underway, and some of them have been underway for quite some time. Those initiatives being mainly the consolidations of human resource management, the Office of Information Technology, the Shared Services of Alaska, which are accounts payable and travel, and the consolidation of the Office of Procurement and Property Management. I would like to see those projects through the finish line. It is ambitious, but my team, we've worked together, and we have decided that it is a realistic goal and that we can complete the consolidations that remain by the end of the year. Two consolidations are more mature than others. They're nearing completion, but we believe we can have the remaining two also complete by the end of the year. Another thing that you'll see through my leadership is commitment and dedication to serving the other departments and the people of Alaska with top-notch customer service. It will start with me and will be the culture of the Department of Administration to provide the best customer service that we can.
Follow up. I didn't realize that the consolidation was that close, which is promising. What do you see as the next steps and priorities for your position after that?
The consolidations, there is still a lot of work to be done to complete those consolidations. It truly will be a heavy lift for both the office of, sorry about that. there is a lot of work to be done, and it will take absolutely the dedication of the entire department to complete those consolidations by the end of the year for both the Office of Information Technology and the Office of Procurement and Property Management. After the consolidations are complete, it will be very important, I believe, to stabilize and assess the success and the efficiencies that we have gained through those consolidations. So the next step will be to stabilize and to assess how we're doing.
All right, thank you.
Representative Eastman, and before you go, I want to note Representative Eastman joined us, as is manifestly evident, at 3:13 p.m. and Representative Kleinman at 3:15. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I saw that there's a sizable appropriation request from the Department of Health and Social Services in our current budget process, and I think some of that goes back to the nice way of saying it would be they were hacked and trying to recover from the data breaches and so forth. What's your assessment of the IT security of your department?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Eastman, for the question. Cybersecurity is a top priority for the Department of Administration and for the administration in general as well. Cybersecurity is a challenge. It is a daily challenge. It's a multifaceted challenge, and it requires a multifaceted approach. I would assess the status of our cybersecurity posture for the state of Alaska as being healthy. However, that doesn't mean that we should, relax or be stagnant in that assessment. I think it requires, constant reassessment and constant improvement and the continued modernization of our cybersecurity tools and our cybersecurity position. We have a dedicated team and we have established strong partnerships throughout the state and the federal government and our other partners across the nation to have a holistic approach to our cybersecurity and our cybersecurity infrastructure.
Follow up. Also through the chair. Now, I know some of the hackings that the state has experienced over the last number of years were not entirely unexpected, I guess, and in some cases there were people who made the state aware that there were concerns, things need to be attended to. What is the strength of the department's ability to receive feedback like that and act on it in a timely manner?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Eastman. We have required all employees at the state of Alaska to participate and to complete cybersecurity training. And part of that includes learning about information, about how do we contact leadership or how do we register sort of a concern if we were to perhaps receive an email, a phishing email or something similar to that. So all employees at the state of Alaska have been educated and have completed that course. And so I hope that answers your question. So there are, we educate and we inform employees so that they are aware of the proper avenues for reporting concerns that they might be aware of, throughout their day.
Thank you.
Representative Story and then Representative Kleinman.
Thank you, through the chair. Welcome, good to see you. A couple questions I had. You have a huge department, really, in personnel, I think like 1,200 employees, so really a big group. And I often think of all the changes with the consolidations happening, and I'm wondering how your assessment is of staff morale with all these changes, and what sort of, as a commissioner, what sort of steps will you take to work with your employees and assess how things are going and any adjustments, things like that?
Through the chair, Representative Story, I believe that our state of Alaska employees are truly our greatest resource, and that we should be very careful to always be in touch with the level, what the morale levels are within the department. I do know that change fatigue is absolutely something that exists and is real, and I believe our department has experienced that at times. I mean, these consolidations are heavy lifts. We oftentimes haven't done the best that we could do, perhaps, for resourcing some of those change initiatives. And so what we have tended to do is to say, we need to consolidate and we need to get that done. And please, you know, also perform your daily work, but also complete the consolidation on top of that. So that is asking a lot, and these consolidations have been underway, as I mentioned earlier, for quite some time. I think the current, my assessment of the current morale level at the department is that I think actually people share in my desire to just to get these consolidations completed, to get them through the finish line. Let's wrap these up. And let's get through this. And I actually think there's a renewed sense of energy behind that and some excitement from the employees that I've been working with and that I'm in touch with. We'll also conduct an employee survey to get a more formal reading on what those morale levels are.
Follow up. Yes, and when we had Director Isaacs before us, when we were the subcommittee, finance subcommittee, he talked about in one situation where there had been a change, like move 44 employees, then they ended up moving, or maybe it was 43, moving 41 back. I don't know if you know much about that situation, but if you could share about that, I'd like to understand that a little bit better.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Story, I do know about what you're referring to, and I think what you're referring to is the positions that are within the Office of Procurement and Property Management. We had a number of positions outlined and designated to move from the departments into the Office of Procurement and Property Management. And those positions did indeed move at one point, I believe it was in July of last year. They moved, and then there was a decision made to pause that consolidation, and that was mainly due to considerations of the IRIS upgrade. We were set to go live with the IRIS Advantage 4.0 upgrade, which did indeed go live a few weeks ago on February 22nd. So the decision was made that we needed to take a closer look at our workflow processes and how they would touch the IRIS system. And because we were, entering into the final stages of getting ready to go live and we had frozen our IRIS system, it was decided to move those positions back to their home departments. That is how that came to be.
And just one more follow-up, please. I'm wondering if the department has strong rationale before moving positions from one duty station to another, and if there is a strong rationale, if you could share that with me, I'd appreciate that.
Through the chair, we have had, we usually take the consideration of a duty station and a position location on a bit of a case-by-case basis and review those, individually. At times, we, for example, may be recruiting for a position that is based in a certain location, and then once the candidate has been identified, that the employee has been, perhaps offered that position, we will assess whether or not, where that person lives. Sometimes with telework, that's another consideration as well. I hope I'm answering your question. I hope I've answered your question.
Follow-up. Just maybe the process that you go through when you're assessing where the position should be, there's a how you go through that, if there is a strong rationale.
Through the chair, I think the ultimate decision on where positions are based, I believe that decision comes from the Office of Management and Budget. So I think that the decision on where to recruit or how to open recruitments for those positions, in other words, would we recruit, open recruitment for Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks, you know, in other words, have an, you know, all location recruitment, that would come from the Department of Administration. But I believe that a change in duty station, I believe that decision resides with the Office of Management and Budget.
Thank you.
Representative Kleeman.
First, are you still an active member of the state bar?
Through the chair, yes, I am.
Follow up. Unrelated to that question, the question of cybersecurity, I'm often struck with cybersecurity a little like the fire department. In an ideal world, all the firefighters ever do is go to schools and teach kids not to play with fire, periodically do safety checks, and sometimes go with the ladder and get a cat out of a tree. But we have a lot of firefighters around the community, so when there is a fire, there's actually enough firefighters to respond and respond as would be appropriate, which impacts our property insurance rates and stuff. And I've been struck when I saw things, I know it was Department of Health and Social Services that had the big cyber attack, but you all are not immune to that in administration. And Health and Human Services went from, I guess, processing death certificates somewhat timely to like a 3 or 4 month delay to process death certificates. And so on this cybersecurity question, I know this is a long narrative to a question, on the cybersecurity topic, it's not just a question of what are you doing to prevent cybersecurity, but what's the capacity for the department to actually, when a cyber attack happens and we don't entirely prevent it, do we actually have enough personnel to get the work done? Because it feels like we don't.
Through the chair, we have the Department of Administration houses the State Security Office. So we have a team dedicated to cybersecurity matters. And so that's very helpful, I think, in, you know, having a team that is already dedicated to that, that being their sole focus is the state's cybersecurity status. So I think that's very helpful in allowing us to continue, you know, the day-to-day work of the department and to allowing the other departments to continue, you know, their daily work as well. So we have a dedicated team and we I believe have adequate resources in that team in order to ensure that our daily work does not suffer in the event of a cybersecurity attack.
Follow up. So that's about the prevention side of the equation. You've got a team and you think you've got enough people to do their best to stop the cyber attacks. I'm asking about now you've got people in administration who aren't on that team that are trying to prevent. Say in DMV, you have there's a cyber breach in DMV, and the wait line currently is, say, an hour to get into DMV, which some might think is a little long, but let's say that's kind of been normal for a while. But then you have a cyber attack, and all of a sudden, because of all the extra work that has to be done manually because of the cyber attack, now the wait goes from an hour to 3 hours or 4 hours at DMV. It feels to me like in those other departments, it feels the same way in HESS. I know you're not with HESS, but it feels the same way with me, that if the data breach happens, the departments that are affected don't have enough personnel to keep their normal workflow going or recover from the cyber attack in any effective way. And I'm wondering what your perspective is, not about your prevention team, but about the rest of the parts of the Department of Administration.
Through the chair, I do believe that the rest of the department, and perhaps I can speak in this area for other departments, you know, we do perform tabletop exercises. We plan, we have planning for when we, you know, hopefully do not have a cyber attack, but when we do experience a cyber attack, or when we have an incident, So we have planned what our responses will be in the event of that. I believe that I can say that in my experience in the past several years, I have not known of within the Department of Administration, in our experience when we have had an incident, I have not seen the daily work of within our department. I have not seen that work slow or suffer. So I believe we're doing a good job of preparing and planning for these events.
And a couple of other follow-ups. These were specific constituent complaints that I think are specific to administration. One was a retired person, and they had put in an application to make a modification in their retirement plan that for that to take effect, it had to get signed off on, or a form had to be approved by Department of Administration. And so in late December, they started the process of doing that, and they were hoping to complete it by year's end because that would keep it much simpler administratively. And they put in the request around the 21st or 22nd of December, but they actually didn't get the department to respond to it until late January, which created all kinds of administrative hassles and problems in terms of making the change effective. I think ultimately it would, but it was an example in your department of lacking personnel to get work done on time. Have you heard about any problems like that?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Klayman, for that question. And I am happy to look into that particular incident as well that you're mentioning, that particular situation. Again, I am committed to providing the best customer service that we can possibly provide, and I do I do hope and I will do my best to ensure that culture is throughout the department. Now, sometimes does that not mean we are, you know, our resources are spread too thinly, or are we falling behind, or do we have too much of a backlog? I would have to look into that particularly, but that, you know, that is concerning to me to hear.
Concerning to me too.
Yes.
It didn't seem like a complicated task.
Right. And I through the chair, I have not heard reports of the Division of Retirement and Benefits perhaps falling behind in areas or having a backlog like what you've mentioned. So I don't know that I can speak to this particular, you know, incident or in general.
I would appreciate, not necessarily hearing, but if you could follow up and let us know. These are things I've just heard in recent days. So when you came by the office, I didn't have a chance. And then one last follow-up. Similar situation, which goes back to the death certificates. It was somebody that lost their spouse, and they were entitled to the retirement benefits as part of the retirement plan, but because of the delays in Health and Human Services getting a death certificate, your department apparently had no way to provide this person with their death benefits for a period of 3 or 4 months because of all these delays and really this is state retirement. The state can't even give state retirement benefits to somebody that's entitled to it. And again, that sounds like there's a lack of personnel to be able to get the work done.
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, and absolutely, the Division of Retirement Benefits must do their part, you know, to try to work in as timely of a way as that they possibly can. It sounds like maybe there was a delay on the part of Vital Statistics for issuing that death certificate, which may be something that's outside of the control of the Division of Retirement and Benefits, but we can certainly look at that and work with, you know, take a look at that policy and see if there are things that we can do, knowing that especially with COVID, you know, we're experiencing delays for doing all sorts of things.
Right.
So maybe we should take a look at that.
Follow up. I would just look at that because particularly with this, I mean, this was a state employee. The state knew the person was dead. And the answer, well, we can't do anything until we get a death certificate. It just seems to strain kind of the sense of really serving the public and responding to those customer service needs. And it leads to my general feeling that not just in your department, there's a lot of departments that are understaffed and are having a tough time getting their essential work done. So those are concerns that I think are ongoing. It doesn't require response, but I'm just real concerned about at all levels of state government that we have done so much cutting and lost so many employees that essential services simply can't get done.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair, Now, what are the department's current policies on employees of the department contacting, having communication with either their legislator or another legislator?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, in their official, you know, in their official status as a state employee, we have a policy where we require communications coming from our departments and the employees within those departments. That communication must flow through our legislative liaison, Mr. Truitt, who happens to be in the room today, Ken Truitt. And so communications, in their official capacity as a state employee, must flow through the legislative liaison in both directions. So, of course, in their personal capacity, you know, employee can do, you know, whatever they see fit.
Follow up.
And what distinguishes that personal capacity from official capacity? If state employee observes something that they think should be a subject of legislation, is that something that would fall under official or personal?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that's a tricky question. I would have to probably assess it, on a case-by-case basis and definitely take a look at the individual communication or the individual concern that the person is trying to relay or discuss with their legislator. Things that I might consider when I looked at that would be, you know, are they speaking on behalf of their division? Are they speaking on behalf of their office unit? Are they speaking on behalf of the department? Well, then that would fall within, you know, I believe the rule that they need to be directing that conversation through the legislative liaison. Perhaps if the communication was, I would consider, you know, what time was the communication maybe made? Was it after hours? Is it strictly in their personal capacity? I would try to take a look at that on a case-by-case individual basis. Hope that answers your question.
Follow up.
And if a department employee observes fraud, waste, or abuse and wants to report that to a legislator, is that something that if they didn't go through the liaison, they would suffer some type of penalty for not going through official channels?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we would always encourage an employee to report any fraud, waste, or abuse that they were aware of. We would recommend that they report that to, you know, whatever proper channels that would be, whether or not it's to their supervisor, wherever that needed to be. We would encourage the reporting of fraud, waste, or abuse, or any concerns like that.
Follow up. And if they were to do that reporting to the legislature without going through the liaison, would they suffer some kind of penalty for doing so?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I am not sure that I can speak, you know, in generalities with the situation. Like I said, I would encourage, you know, and we as a department would encourage reports to proper authorities or a proper chain of command for fraud, waste, or abuse concerns. The question of whether or not a person should speak to a legislator, I just haven't considered that yet, and I apologize for that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. The chair on a different topic. Now, last time I had spoken with the department, the department was responsible for managing most, if not all, of the IP addresses owned by the state of Alaska. And many of those were not actually being used because the department contracts out to various vendors for services, and part of those contracts includes availability of IP addresses owned by third parties. Can you bring me up to speed on what is the status or the department's plans on use or non-use of the IP addresses? There are some tens of thousands currently owned, managed by the department.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I'm actually not familiar with the IP address concern that you're raising. I do know that during COVID, the state of Alaska and many departments purchased many laptops to enable telework for employees across the state. And I, you know, and in that purchase and in that distribution and the use of those laptops, I did not hear any concerns over IP addresses or any concerns with that.
Thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Pardon me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question so much as a comment. Thank you, because we were able to meet and talk in, you know, about your resume and interest in the department. Appreciate the comments and questions by colleagues. I just wanted to add to the conversation that among the myriad responsibilities of the department include the very important responsibilities of the Public Defender Agency and the Office of Public Advocacy. And so I just don't want to not bring them into the conversation at all. And in terms of staffing, we know those are areas where there have been staffing issues. And over the last couple of years, I know we've funded some additional positions. So I just, in your, you know, time that you're there over these next several months, I know the hiring to fill those positions will still be part of the work plan, and hope it's a priority. And just wanted to express that, you know, I think those are among very important roles in state government, among cybersecurity and retirement and all of the other responsibilities that Department of Administration has. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions at this time, Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The State Affairs Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to the joint session for consideration: Paula Verana to the position of Commissioner, Department of Administration. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Thank you, and we'll circulate the paperwork. And just a personal comment, very much appreciate your leadership at the Department of Administration. It's great to have a steady hand at the agency.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for making the time. With that, we'll move on to the next item on today's agenda, and we have Senator L.V. Gray Jackson. Welcome, Senator. And Representative Tarr, you're welcome to situate yourself wherever you feel most comfortable, but we have both SB 7 and HB 255 noticed for today. Given that there's a Senate bill a little bit farther in the process, that will, of course, be the vehicle. But Senator L.V. Gray Jackson or Representative Tarr, you're welcome to start however you two would best see fit and present the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you don't mind, Representative Karen, I would love to start.
Sure. Okay.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank the committee. For the record, this is Senator L.V. Gray Jackson, District Guy. I'd like to thank the committee for being willing to hear on my bill. And the bill is pretty basic. It is requiring that the Department of Public Safety publish policies and procedures, their policies and procedures on the internet. You know, the role of the Department of Public Safety is to provide safety within our Alaskan communities, and the public should be able to easily access the policies and procedures that the department has online. And this is simply what that bill is doing. And if I may add, the department is already publishing policies and procedures, but the reason for this bill is because leadership changes and new leadership can decide that they no longer want to publish the policies and procedures. But if it's in state statute, they really have no choice. They have to do it, which they should, because, again, the public should be able to easily access the department's policies and procedures. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to introduce my staffer, Keith Bogus. It's a really basic sectional analysis. If you'd like for him to read it, I'm more than happy to have him do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee.
Thank you, Senator. And Representative Tarr, any comments you'd like to make before we go into the simple sectional?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, you know, we've been collaborating with Senator Gray Jackson's office on this legislation. And I can't remember, I think our version doesn't have the amendments that were made in the Senate Judiciary Committee. So I just would point members to, you know, make sure we're looking at the most up-to-date version of the bill.
Noted. Thank you. I think we can proceed with the sectional at this point with making sure we're looking at the most recent version.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, my name is Keith Vargas, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. So today's sectional analysis for SB 7 concerning online transparency from the Department of Public Safety. Section 1 amends AS 44-441-020 to add the Department of Public Safety shall publish on their website the current policies and procedures related to the conduct of peace officers employed or regulated by the department.
Right, voluminous. With that, questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And with that, I'm curious to ask the next question of who or what specifically inspired the creation of this statute? Obviously, we understand that it doesn't change current policy, but are there specific concerns from specific parties that led to this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I was inspired to bring this bill forward. Thank you.
Follow up. And what inspired you, Senator?
What inspired me was the many actions across the country that have happened, in particular George Floyd and others. And we've had incidences within the municipality of Anchorage in 2019 specifically. But I was even inspired to do something even before that, because this isn't things that are just now occurring, things that have been occurring for quite some time. Thank you, Mr. Representative Eastman.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing this forward. Welcome, Senator, and welcome, Mr. Burgess. So I just wanted to make sure, talking about the changes that had come over from the Senate, and is that adding the village public safety officers? Am I following that correctly?
Yes.
Yeah, that seems very important. So I'm glad to see that. Thank you.
Representative Story. Mr. Chairman, may I follow up with yes. Representative Story's concern? Representative Story, that was the first amendment that the Judiciary Committee made, and they also made another amendment to make it clear that any confidential information would not be provided. Any confidential information that would disclose the techniques and procedures for enforcement investigations would not be provided, and any guidelines for law enforcement investigations and prosecutions would not be provided. Thank you, Representative Story. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. Now, that raises an interesting question. So if a member of the public is going onto the website to look for policies and procedures, and obviously some of those policies and procedures aren't going to be displayed, is there a way for them to know sort of what's missing and what has been sort of not published for each of the exemptions that are in the statute?
Thank you, Representative Eastman. I'm not really clear on what you're asking, because the statute, when it's passed, will provide what is not going to be in the policies and procedures. So are you asking if there's going to be something on that website that basically says, okay, here's the policies and procedures, but this information is not included? Is that what you're asking? Well, that would be a question for the Department of Public Safety, and maybe somebody from the department is online who can answer that question for you. Thank you, Mr. Eastman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Online we have...
Representative Eastman, sorry about that.
Online we have Lieutenant Eric Olson with the Alaska State Troopers. Lieutenant Olson, if you caught the question, could you put yourself on record and speak to it?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Eastman. My name is Eric Olson. I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers. I'm stationed at headquarters, and I work for the director of the Alaska State Troopers. On our website, we have noted that any redactions have been limited to those which are applicable to the Alaska statute. 40251020A6EF4G.
Follow up.
And those are going to be referring to another statute, which we don't have in front of us right now. Are those roughly similar to the exemptions that are listed in this statute, or is there a way of tying those two things together, I guess?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, can you be specific as to which statute you're referring to, please?
Yes, I'm specifically looking at SB 7 and it's listing here various reasons why something would not be disclosed. And is the department's plan, if this does go into effect, to reference any of the specific exemptions here in this bill, or just to reference exemptions that are listed in other statutes?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, our department is would have to be in consultation with the commissioner's office as far as any additional information stated to the public on that, and I'd have to get back to you as to how that would place.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
And what is the department's position on Senate Bill 7?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we have no official position on this bill.
Representative Klayman.
Sounds like the department's policies are currently available on the web. I know it's on the web, but sort of roughly in terms of pages. How many pages are the current policies? I haven't taken the time to look, so I'm kind of curious.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Klayman. I have no idea how many pages there are, but you may ask the person that's online who would know. I've seen it, but I know it's lengthy. Thank you, Representative Klayman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If the trooper online could provide an idea of how extensive, how long they are.
Yeah, Lieutenant Olson, how much material are we talking about?
Through the chair, Representative Klayman, when I started back in 1992, our procedures manual is maybe about an inch thick. Then it, as years went by, it went into binders, and now it's specifically online. There's hundreds and hundreds of pages. I don't have a specific number, but I can get back to you on it. I know it's grown exponentially over my career.
Not a fault, but just a comment. I think that answers the question, because sometimes we see procedures that are one or two pages, and if his answer is hundreds and hundreds, I think that answers my curiosity.
Any additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Senator, for joining us. We'll set
thank
the bill.
Thank you, Chairman and committee. Thank you.
Aside, and we will be in touch regarding a possible amendment deadline. The last item on today's agenda from Representative Josephson is House Bill 271 relating to ADA. Representative Josephson, welcome. And go ahead, put yourself on the record and present the legislation.
Thank you. I'm going to be relatively fast. My name is Andy Josephson, District 17, Midtown Anchorage. And if I dash away, it's not meant to be rude. It's that I'm supposed to meet with a colleague from the other body. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what you have before you is a bill to reform ADA, the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. And this has been something that I've thought about for a number of years. I'm with Ms. Soren Burke of my office, and when I'm done in just a few minutes, she'll present a PowerPoint for you. And you'll see an illustration of some of the, or headlines of some of the controversial topics related to ADA that have happened historically. In fairness, ADA's had its successes, and when you put your toe in the water, sometimes it's hot, and mistakes happen, and we understand that. But there have been a lot of criticism of this authority, And we've talked to some of those critics in putting together what's really sort of an omnibus bill. We don't pretend that it covers every issue or that it doesn't need some adjustment. And fundamentally, to provide a little context, the genesis of this bill was a concern that ADA for years has become more than an authority, that it is sort of almost sovereign, in that it just does what it will. It has laws it complies with, but we think that there needs to be a reconsideration and reevaluation of its purpose fundamentally. So just to move quickly through some of what the bill does, the bill would change the authority's membership. There would be five public members, and there still are public members, but they would be confirmed by the legislature. And it is true that that gets into a gray area, so I'm being candid about that, about the legislature's role in confirming folks who are not traditional department heads, like commissioners. But we think that that's an important reform. Also, at page 2 of the bill, you'll see that the types of people that would be appointed provide the diversity that Alaska affords. There would be a representative of a Native tribal government. There would be somebody who has experience in private sector investment of over $20 million. There would be a socially responsible investor. This was something that this committee heard in House Bill 251 on reform of the APFC, the Permanent Fund Corporation. And then a month later, there was an invasion of a peaceful sovereign country called Ukraine. And this has become very fundamental to our way of thinking now. There would be a member with experience in renewable energy. This is fundamental to Alaska as well. And I note that the governor has become a serious proponent, as the chair knows, of renewable energy projects. We would also, the authority would be required to have a personnel policy. You might think, well, what authority wouldn't have a personnel policy? Well, we believe that this authority, it may have some sort of personnel policy, but it's not required by statute. And there's been a number of people, and this is featured in the Daily News and other media accounts, who have sued the authority for what they deem are arbitrary and capricious terminations. Yet another problem ADA has suffered from. And another way in which we think the overall reforms are important, because ADA is sort of insulated from other checks and balances, we would submit. In Section 5, and I apologize to Ms. Sorenberg because she's going to go over this again. You'll know it better than you ever could have. But ADA conducts some of its business by motion. That may sound typical enough. But they meet in long executive sessions. Nobody really knows what happens. And, of course, that's the nature of executive sessions. We all understand that. But they make a lot of their decisions by motion rather than resolution. And the problem with that is the public can't offer comment on a motion because they don't know what's coming. With a resolution, under the next section, Section 6, they would have notice and an opportunity to be heard, and that notice would be extended to 30 days rather than the current 15. And one of the things I was astonished at when the bill was being drafted is that the public testimony opportunity, currently under law, is limited to one cumulative hour. That's it. And, you know, the public wouldn't tolerate that in the legislature. And we all have sat for 5-6 hours sometimes for certainly the operating budget and bills of that sort. So this would require 2 minutes testimony, something the chair is familiar with, and offer more public opportunity to be heard. The bill then would require ADA to husband less money than it currently husbands. And I would note that the administration in its first year, FY20, had proposed spending a couple hundred million dollars of ADA money. I don't know if it was on permanent fund dividends or tax credits. to the oil industry. But ADA does accumulate money. It is currently required generally to share from its revolving fund not less than 25%, but we would submit that it should share more. And so the bill for the revolving fund, the SETS fund, which is Sustainable Energy Transmission Fund, and the Arctic Infrastructure Development Fund, for each of those, we would require that ADA deposit to the general fund not 25%, but as much as 50% of those funds. The next issue, and this again is responsive to criticism, is that ADA doesn't seem especially focused, and I suspect they're listening. I want to be fair to them, but they don't seem especially focused on local interests. So if there isn't local buy-in, that doesn't deter ADA. They push ahead. And of course, local buy-in, we see split opinions all the time. But what this bill does is it requires that that local governments pass resolutions reflecting their consent with projects when those projects expend more than $10 million and where there is an unorganized area that does not have a local government, a system that's already in place but we think is underutilized called the Regional Resource Advisory Council would be appointed. So in a very rural part of Alaska, the governor, I believe, would appoint members to the Regional Resource Advisory Council that would meet as if they were a local government and give their consent. They would review a project and they would comment on that project and they could or would offer their blessing. The key section, if someone said, what is the section we should focus on in this bill, Representative Josephson, I would say you would want to focus on Section 9. So that's new law. That is where if projects cost more than $10 million, whether that is by way of loans, grants, or bonding, ADA would have to defend the need for the project by showing the kinds of consent I talked about, but also showing that the project was economically advantageous, that it was in the general public welfare, that ADA would have to comment on its social environmental effects. So ADA tends to, in my view, have a sort of tunnel vision, and this would require them to open up that vision and think more globally about their work. And so this is the kind of bill you have before you. I'm trying to see if there's anything else that I think is critical that I want to share with you. I think at this point I will defer to Ms. Sorenberg, but one thing that is also, I think, important is that ADA is not that transparent, we think, about its records and information. That is in section of law called 4488215. They used to have a version of that law that was not so proprietary. Of course, they'll say, well, we can't foster development if people's personal proprietary information becomes public. We go through this in myriad bills, of course. But we think that that's become an issue as well, that the public doesn't know who's investing, how solvent are they, what is their history, that sort of information. If there are any questions at this time that I can try to answer, I'd be happy to do so. And I'll stop there.
Representative Vance.
Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Josephson, for highlighting this issue. This has been issue of transparency has been brought to my attention. And ADA's tendency to just suddenly go into executive session for lengthy amounts of time and people don't know what's going on. So can you highlight how this bill is going to address that and just provide better interface with the public?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, a fantastic question, and people say that, but I mean it. I think that if there's one area in this bill that we have not developed well enough, and I talked to Ms. Sorenberg about this today, it's that issue. And how do you strike a balance between what should be heard in executive session and what shouldn't be? Ada has had issues with personnel, and they're being sued by, I think, multiple former employees. There have been coverage in the media about this. We know that when we have personnel matters, legislative bodies go into executive session. That's typically legislative council or legislative budget and audit. When there's litigation, it makes sense to go into executive session. Ada is in executive session all the time. And I think that one area that we could use the help of this body would be to delve in with assistance of our attorneys into what the limits of that should be, and that would be a very friendly amendment.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Now, on the topic of interaction with the public, you're updating in Section 6 of the bill the 15-day requirement for notice of proposed action to 30 days. And I see in here there's a list of requirements that needs to be posted to 3 newspapers of general circulation in the state. But there's no reference about putting it on the website of the organization. I'm wondering, you know, maybe that's somewhere else where I'm missing it, or is that, if that's not there, is that something that would be a friendly amendment as well?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the word that comes to mind for me is definitely. That would be definitely a friendly amendment. And frankly, it speaks to how dated ADA's Enabling Act is. I mean, that's what comes to mind, that there probably wasn't an internet when this was written. But yes, a second friendly amendment.
I follow up.
A third friendly amendment, Representative Eastman?
I'm just noticing in another hearing here this week, we were talking about, well, how many newspapers of general circulation are there? And I think someone was saying, well, maybe there's only one, just because, you know, it's as far as statewide newspapers, that might also maybe be part of that amendment. I don't know the value in some of these cases of requiring, you know, an agency to spend money, you know, in a newspaper if people aren't going to be looking for the information in a newspaper. You know, I guess some people read the classifieds. I generally don't, but just a thought there. On a different question or a different topic, though, the language dealing with at the will of the governor is being removed. And I'm just wondering, from a legal perspective, does removing the words at the pleasure of the governor, does that legally mean that the governor can no longer sort of just whenever they want remove these people or replace them? What's the legal effect? Is that sufficient?
Through the chair, this issue, Representative Eastman, this issue comes up in my permanent fund corporation bill as well. And, you know, it's important that we be candid about certain things. And that is, if you're fond of your president or your governor, you want them to have wide and liberal appointing authority. And you want them to be able to clear the decks and appoint their people. And you're cheerleading the concept of an electoral mandate and all of those sorts of things. What we've done here, though, is we've said that we would have 5-year staggered terms so that, over a 2-term governorship, you could certainly see your own people come in. But this is an effort, I think, to depoliticize it as before in the other bill, 251, and to have greater continuity. And I suspect that part, the part that I think our attorneys would want to offer you advice on, is less that concern than the confirmation issue.
Which was going to be another question. Could you speak to the confirmation issue and just what is your perspective on various legal arguments about our ability to confirm in this situation?
You know, I think that it goes to the question of the heads of principal departments. That clearly is an area where we confirm. There was some litigation involving this, of course, in the last couple of years, when there was this delay in having a confirmation hearing, I believe, if I've got it right. This is not a regular department of the governor of the government. And so you get into this area of whether the governor's appointing authority is what I would call plenary or absolute. But Ms. Sorenberg may want to add something on that. We have a legal opinion we can share.
Well, thank you. And I'm all about legal opinions, but I know that it's just an opinion. So I was kind of just wanting to make sure I understood your opinion on this, because I know there are competing interpretations.
Sure.
Additional questions from the committee? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Now, I know the period of public interactions with the agency was on page 3 in section 6, the 2 minutes provision. And I'm just wanting to make sure that we're not accidentally or inadvertently limiting that period, because I know the current language is that it has to be at least an hour, and I guess it could be more than that. Has that, I guess, been abused? Has that hour been used to say we're not going above an hour when more than an hour would probably be appropriate? Because I know now we're not guaranteeing an hour. We're just guaranteeing someone 2 minutes. So I guess if there's fewer than 30 people trying to speak, then we actually have a net loss of time.
Through the chair, good question. I think that I would need to follow up on that, except that to see what the specific criticism is, except for this. In the time period of 2019 to 2021, sort of that range of time, I was getting repeated contacts, and I was engaged. I mean, I testified before Ada myself, from the public about these long executive sessions, the inability to have sufficient notice, the inability to participate, the inability to understand what the board's position was because it was discussed in the executive session, and just feeling like they couldn't fully participate. And it was in a way unlike anything I hear in our own work. I mean, what we hear in our work is, you had your public hearing at 3 and I'm working then. And that's a decent criticism. But overall, given the scores of public hearings that happen in this building daily, certainly weekly, there's not much. And during this one key point from 2019 to 2021, and a lot of it involved the Ambler Mining District, frankly, and criticism of that, that was felt and felt strongly, the inability to access the board and be heard.
Follow up. And then just another line down from that, also on page 3, where it talks about requiring written responses to public comments. I'm concerned that that might necessitate a substantial amount of work from the department, especially if you have, I guess there's various automated tools now to generate large numbers of comments. And I'm just wondering, is your intent that the agency respond sort of in a blanket or general response and that might summarize response to various, or it does say responses plural. We're not asking them to respond to each individual comment if there's thousands of them, I hope.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think that clause that you're referring to at line 7, page 3, could use some editing. But anyway, beyond that, I don't know.
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chair, with great profuse apology, I need to be down the hall. May I do that?
You absolutely may.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a question in the queue from Representative Vance, and then we can let Ms. Soren Burke have the spotlight for a few minutes as well. Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think either Ms. Soren Burke or anyone else that has more experience than I do may be able to answer this question. Regarding the question about the public comment period and whether it's not less than 2 minutes or whatever, is this customary to have this written into the policy? Because I would think that you'd want to give the flexibility to the chair so that it can kind of meet the need for relevant information. I'm just wondering if it's needed that we outline in that, and I guess my goal is to be consistent with other policies. It seems like an interesting carve-out. Do you have any insight into that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, Elise Swornbrook for the record. I don't have a very clear answer for that. I will tell you that in the existing statute, it does say 1 hour. So the existing ADA statute has the 1 hour minimum, or 1 hour. You must do at least 1 hour of public testimony. Representative Josephson's thought on that was that there needed to be a guarantee that every person could be heard, instead of ADA having the legal and statutory ability to cut people off after an hour.
Follow-up? One of the concerns that I've heard specifically with ADA is, unlike the legislature, there wouldn't be a specific set time for public testimony. And so members who wanted to testify would spend their entire day when they're trying to work, and they would have their phone tied up, and they would be waiting hours and hours and hours, and then suddenly they would go into executive session not knowing when that public testimony time is. So I would be interested in possibly having it written out to have a set time. I don't know how our requirements are written, where you have to post this a set time for public testimony, so that it was very clear to the public when the opportunity could be. Obviously, people have to wait in line, you know, just like with us, but that may be a direction that provides better clarity and provide that interface with the public that I think all of us are looking for.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, I think Representative Josephson would appreciate speaking with you more about that idea. And I think, as he sort of alluded to, this isn't a perfect bill. It's a starting point. And it's basically saying, there are these issues that we know about. What are things we can do? So it's definitely looking to be kind of a collaborative effort.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Soren Burke, if you'd like to, I would say, not quite light speed, but a brisk gait, run us through the 10 slides, given I think Representative Josephson covered probably nearly the entirety of the subject matter in his opening comments, please do.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Kreis-Tompkins and members of the committee. Elise Soren Burke for the record. Today I'm going to just do a brief presentation on HB 271 relating to ADA reform and transparency. So this is the slide that Representative Josephson alluded to. These are just a few of the recent, and by recent I mean 2016 to present, headlines in media relating to ADA. There is kind of a long history of good and bad when it comes to ADA. ADA's been around since 1967, wasn't really active until the 80s. And so with ADA statutes, you really have a patchwork. You have a lot of different programs that were created at a lot of different times that have a lot of different requirements, and that can lead to some confusion, some difficulties, and some challenges in the public process. So I'll just do a quick run through this of the sectional. I won't go into too much detail, since Representative Josephson did a pretty good job going into what each section does. So section one of the bill requires confirmation by the legislature of public members of the ADA board. Section two stipulates that ADA board members serve staggered five-year terms, switching that from two-year terms, and remove the language at the pleasure of the governor. Section three outlines membership requirements, and I'll go into that a little more detail on another slide. So basically saying those public members each need to have specific qualifications. Section four requires the ADA executive director to be confirmed by the legislature and additionally adds a requirement for ADA to develop personnel policies and minimum requirements for the executive director position in either regulation or bylaws. Section five requires ADA to pass resolutions in order to adopt regulations. So current statute 44.88.085B is very ambiguous. It is about how they can adopt regulations now, and it's kind of, we thought by resolution was a much more succinct, clear-cut way to do it. Right now it says they can do that by motion. It's a little bit too fluid. So section six requires a 30-day notice rather than a 15-day notice before adoption, amendment, or repeal of ADA regulations, and also deals with the public testimony aspect that we just spoke about. Section seven requires that at least 50% of the net income from ADA's various funds be put towards paying the dividend to the state annually. Currently in statute, that ranges between 25% and 50%, and ADA has gone much more towards the 25% level historically. Section 8 expands the provisions existing in AS 44.88.174A relating to appointments of the Regional Resource Advisory Councils in areas lacking local governments to include the parts of section, to include the parts of statutes adopted under Section 9 of the bill. Section 9 outlines project oversight requirements for any project requiring more than $10 million in financing or direct funding. Under A of this section, projects must be approved by a resolution of a local governing body, must show they are economically advantageous, financially feasible, encouraging of increased employment, and in compliance with applicable law. Additionally, the project applicants must show financial responsibility, and any increase in needs for public facilities must be noted. You'll see that B, C, and D all relate to this. So in existing law, this structure that we're using for a much broader set of subjects does exist. It only applies to very large projects that require bonding. It applies to and are paid out of the economic development account. So it's a very narrow section of law that we've broadened to apply to a much more diverse group of projects. Section 10 creates new section 44.88.185, requiring ADA to prioritize projects that further the state energy policy and the state Arctic policy, and I'll touch on that in a later slide. Section 11 amends AS 44.88.210A to require ADA to develop performance metrics relating to job creation, industry growth, financial assistance to businesses, and impact on private investments. And that section relates to the legislative intent at the beginning of ADA statutes. There is very clear legislative intent outlined in statute. There is little done to check up on if that intent has been followed over the decades. So the next section is 12. And that repeals and reenacts AS 44.88.221, the current statute, which allows confidentiality of ADA records, and clarifying that the information submitted to the authority is subject to the Alaska Public Records Act. It creates a waiver process for receipt of information to the authority, and I'll touch on that more in a later slide as well. Section 13 repeals 44.88.030B, which is the part of statute allowing commissioners to designate authority to someone else to serve on the ADA board. Section 14 is uncodified transitional language for how the new board structure would be adopted, and Section 15 is the effective date. So I'll skip over this. These are the major components of the bill. So board structure, Representative Josephson touched on this at length, so I will just skip over this slide. Transparency and record outcomes. I would like to spend a moment on this slide. So current law that we're talking about is AS 44.88.215. It is a law that was first adopted in 1998, and this is adding that confidentiality language to statute. This language was further strengthened in 2010 with HB 90. So per legislative records, when you're looking at minutes from meetings in 1998, there was some questioning of, you know, how ADA dealt with confidentiality of records prior to this statute being in existence. They had a way of filling out waivers, so anyone who was trying to get financing with them would have to basically say, I acknowledge that I'm going to be subject to the Public Records Act. So under the Alaska Public Records Act, AS 40.25, there are already exceptions that exist for certain kinds of financial information that are already required to be confidential under federal law. So a lot of the types of information that people might think were sensitive, there are, you know, already exceptions to those being public records. So project oversight and legislative approval, we went into this in pretty good detail already as well. So this is one I'd like to spend a little bit of time on. So one thing that we thought would be beneficial was to try to have ADA better align with state policies and legislative intent. So the state has some pretty strong existing policies for state energy policy, state Arctic policy, and the legislative intent for creating ADA was very explicit in what they wanted ADA to do and be for our state. So the state energy policy, ADA is also, you know, houses AEA, Alaska Energy Authority, so, and deals with a lot of financing on energy projects. We just want ADA to start to think about how the financing and the projects they're supporting further, you know, the economic development through development of both renewable and non-renewable energy resources, how it furthers applied research on an alternative or emerging technology, how it furthers coordinated and comprehensive approaches to energy efficiency, and then in the state Arctic policy, how it helps develop vibrant communities and a healthy environment, and how it thinks about strategic infrastructure in the Arctic. So these are all things that ADA could really help with and be a good mechanism for change. So I mean, I think the overall question here, and Representative Josephson alluded to this, is what do we want ADA to be? What do Alaskans want ADA to be? And there's been some disagreement about that over the years. Is it a development finance organization? Yes. Is it a state-funded bank? Sort of. Is it the economic development authority for the state? Sort of. So it's one of those things where, what direction does the legislature want ADA to take? What direction should Alaskans take with this massive organization? That's my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think running with the comments made, I think it was you, Ms. Remberg, and or Representative Justice, and as this is a starting point, I think most of all, I'd like to maybe outline a process where committee members can engage with Representative Justice and among ourselves to figure out where there might be the most shared interest in reforms, and that may not necessarily be every section of the bill before us. But I think, at least as chair, that would be my interest in this process. And so, and we think there's a diverse array of concerns that have bubbled up over the years regarding ADA, at least speaking for myself, I think that's true. And would like to sort of curate a process where we're optimizing for broadest interest from the committee. So with that noted, maybe if there are a couple of informational questions on the sort of placeholder bill, as it were, before us, we can have at it. But also, I think, interested in a sort of robust conversation and dialogue outside committee as well among committee members and the sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Price Tompkins.
Well, seeing no questions, I think we can continue this. Thank you very much for the overview and giving us a lot of different ideas to consider. And we will wrap up today's meeting. I'll be in touch probably regarding an amendment deadline for SB 9, Senator Gray Jackson's legislation, although that's not noticed for next week, and I don't have the intent to hear it next week. A couple of housekeeping notes. I have a surgery post-op, so I will actually be out of town for Thursday's meeting, but Representative Clayman will be able to keep the train going, and I'll be in by phone, and we're going to knock out all of the requested confirmation hearings that day, as well as some other pieces of legislation, including a somewhat timely second hearing on daylight saving time. And then on Tuesday, I don't expect quite the marathon as last Tuesday, but may go a bit past 5 o'clock as well. So just wanted to flag that. So with that, at 4:32 p.m., we're adjourned and we'll be back on Tuesday.